Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Many of you knew Brandon Sanderson from his multitude of books, Elantris, the Mistborn series, the Alcatraz series for kids, but many, many more people have come to know him since Harriet McDougall, Robert Jordan's wife and editor, asked Brandon to continue the Wheel of Time. We're delighted to welcome Brandon back to the Tattered Cover, as we did welcome Robert Jordan many times. We hope to hear the story of how the Gathering Storm came to be and hear from Brandon about that. Would you please join me in making Brandon Sanderson feel welcome?
Hey guys, thank you very much for coming. I am Brandon. So, The Gathering Storm. Does someone want to loan me a copy to read out of? I suppose I could take this one. Some people like to have me read out of their copy, so I'll do that. All right. This has been an extremely surreal experience. Very, very surreal. I picked up Eye of the World for the first time. It says this in the foreword, when I was 15. It was a little corner bookstore, a little independent. It was called Cosmic Comics. It sold science fiction, fantasy books, and comic books. I was never into comic books. I was into, you know, they just weren't long enough. I was a poor, you know, I worked a paper route. That's where my money came from. I liked good page density in my books. And fantasy was pretty good at delivering good page density. Beyond that, fantasy tended to have the longer series, which I really liked, because if I'm going to invest this much time into learning a new world and characters, I wanted to be able to spend some time there. I remember when I walked in the store and there was a new book on the shelves in the new release bay, and it was a big book. My, was it a big book. In fact, I think it was the biggest book I had ever seen. It was The Eye of the World in paperback. Enormous. And I said, ooh, that's good money. Good pages for my money. We'll give this book a try. And that book changed the way I looked at fiction. Over the next years, I found myself more and more wanting to become a writer, and Robert Jordan became my model. When I was in my early 20s, I can remember reading through the series one time specifically to learn how he did it, looking at it as a writer. I was taking notes, and I was looking actually at the prose and learning how Robert Jordan did viewpoint and storytelling. He became, in a way, my mentor, as I'm sure he was a mentor to many authors of my era who are writing fantasy. I did not ever meet him. I saw him once at a convention, kind of like you guys are seeing me, but I was too chicken to go up and talk to him. I now wish that I had, but that was the only time I ever saw him. I think it was World Fantasy Convention in Texas that I saw him, but it was one of the World Fantasies. I'm not sure if it was that one. And when he passed away, my immediate thought was of the tragedy of what we had lost. And then, of course, my second thought was, oh no, the series. did he write the ending? Do we know who killed Asmodean? All of these things. And you know, moments of panic. I took a few days thinking about it and eventually wrote a eulogy for him on my website. People ask a lot how I ended up doing this book. They assume maybe that I had known Robert Jordan ahead of time, or that that I had applied, that there had been some application process. Neither is true. I did not know him. And beyond that, I did not apply or send in or ask or anything like that. I was just kind of in a sort of shocked numbness. We all thought that he was going to pull through, and he'd been very positive on his blog, even just a short time before he passed away. And so, no, I did not apply for this. What happened is that eulogy that I wrote ended up in the hands of a dear friend of Harriet McDougall, who is Robert Jordan's widow and wife and editor. She read it and was very touched by it and passed it on to Harriet. Harriet, before Robert Jordan passed away, had been asked by him to find someone. She is quite well known as an editor, a genius in her own right. She was the first person that that Tom Doherty hired when he founded Tor. She became his editorial director. She edited some of the very big books in the genre. Ender's Game was one of her books, if you weren't aware of that. She discovered Robert Jordan and then published him and then married him. And in that order, she actually had married him before they did The Wheel of Time. They went together to pitch it to Tom Doherty. She considered it a dying request that she find someone to be working on the series. Robert Jordan, before he passed away, he spent many of the last periods in his life dictating what should happen to in his series. He was very concerned for his readers, very worried that they would not get the story. He loved you all very, very much. Listening to those last days, listening to Wilson and Harriet speak of them, you can sense his overwhelming love for those who had supported him as he had created this story that was his vision. And she... Right, even on the day of the funeral, people said she could not rest until she knew the book was in someone's hands. And so she began asking for advice, for suggestions, and that eulogy ended up in her hands because of Elise Matheson, who's actually up for a World Fantasy Award today, I believe. So best of luck to her. She's a jeweler, and she's done fantasy-themed jewelry for a while, so she's up for an award for that. And Harriet read it, and she called Tom Doherty and said, "Who is this? Looks like he writes for you guys. Writes for us, I suppose, since she's with Tor." He said, "Yeah, let me send you some of his books." He sent her Mistborn. She called me on the phone and asked if I would be interested. Before she spent the time learning about my work and things, she wanted to know if I'd be interested. This came manifest to me as a voicemail left on my phone one morning. I got up from bed. She's 2 hours ahead of me on the East Coast. I got up from bed, just checked my voicemail, expecting the random things, and Robert Jordan's widow had called me and asked me to call her back, and she said, "There's something I want to talk to you about." Yeah. Talk about a strange experience. My wife says that I was more nervous that day than on our wedding day. There's just a little bit of bitterness in her voice when she says that. And I always respond, I had months to get ready for the wedding. This came out of nowhere. I eventually got a hold of Harriet again after calling my editor. After calling her and she didn't answer, she was actually out at the moment. So I called my editor. He didn't answer. I called my agent. He didn't answer. So I just kind of walked around in circles babbling for a little bit. Eventually got a hold of her and she said, "Well, I'm looking for people to finish The Wheel of Time, to complete the materials that Jim left behind." His real name was Jim Rigney. And I was wondering if you would be interested. My response was, "Ah, blah, blah, blah." No, really. I was so worried about how uncertain I sounded. Some of you heard the story before, but I actually wrote her an email the next day that said, "Dear Harriet, I promise I'm not an idiot." But it was so surprising. And, I didn't know the answer. I told her yes. I told her yes with a great weight of fear, trepidation, and worry. And I spent that whole night worrying. It was very difficult to sleep, saying, "What am I doing? What am I getting into?" And I realized something that night. I realized that I should not have my phone near this. Oh, I don't know where my phone is, so it's not my phone. I realized that what should be happening is Robert Jordan should be finishing the series. That would be the best case. And no one can replace him. I cannot replace him. This book will not be as good as Robert Jordan could have written it by definition, because only he could have written it right. And I realized that. I realized I would never be able to write it as well as he could have. But I also realized that if someone out there was going to write it, I did not want anyone else doing it but me, because they would screw it up. And I mean that with the most sincerity that I can put together. I'm sure there are lots of authors who would have tried very hard. But I had read Eye of the World 8 times at that point, and I knew of no other fantasy author who had read Robert Jordan as much as I had, and who had defended the books as much as I had, and who had the reverence for the characters and series that I had. And I knew that if someone was going to finish it, then I could finish it in the least wrong way. Does that make sense? And that's why I wrote her that email, and I explained it. I said, Harriet, I do want to do this. I said yes yesterday, but I was scared yesterday. Today, I'm terrified, but at the same time, I know that I want to do this because I will be able to do it in a way that it still feels like a Wheel of Time book, and that the characters remain the same characters that they have been, and that people will be able to read it and read this book and feel like, yes, this is a Wheel of Time book. I'm getting the story that I was promised, and it has not been ruined. I still worry that I'm going to ruin it. That's a constant worry, but at least I have that worry, if that makes any sense. And so that's how it happened. She read Mistborn, the first one, The Final Empire, and she called me back and said, I knew after just 20 pages that you were the right one. She says, I actually fell asleep. It wasn't because of you. It's because of the week of Jim's death. I was exhausted. I'd read, it was actually 40 pages, she said. I read it. I fell asleep, and I woke up, and the world and characters were so vivid in my mind still that I knew, and I had to keep reading, and that's why she did it. So that's why she chose me. It was the shortest contract negotiation of my entire career, because I called my agent and said, guess what? He said, oh, well, we'll get the contract and see. And I said, no, we'll get the contract and say yes. We're not going to argue with Harriet McDougal. We are going to say yes so I can do this book. He was not terribly pleased with that, but, agent's job is to argue. And there was no reason to anyway, because Harriet treated me very, very fairly and honorably, too much so, I think. And so, we said yes. I was in Charleston 1 week later, I believe, and it was actually a very long flight from Salt Lake to Charleston. I walked in. It was like 11 o'clock at night. She had fixed some dinner. She knew I hadn't eaten. She said, oh, would you like something to eat? And I said, no, please. I would like the ending. Yes. By that point, I knew that she had told me that Robert Jordan had written the last chapter himself. The last scenes were done, and there was an outline, and there was also a sheet that said who killed Asmodean, and it was all in a stack, and she laughed, and she handed me that, and I sat down in Robert Jordan's chair next to his computer, and I read that. And the ending is the right ending. I'm not going to change it. I will stay out of it. There may be some editing that needs to be done and things like that. But my default has been, if Robert Jordan wrote something, then it goes in, and we make sure that I'm not changing things around unless the story really demands it. And so I read that, and having followed the books for 18 years, it was the right ending. You'll get to read it eventually. I'm sorry it's taking me so long. I am only one person, and there's only so quick. I can only write so quickly, particularly with the number of characters, plot lines, threads, world building. There's so much to the series that it is a lot of work to get it right. It took me 18 months to get the Gathering Storm to you. But the second one will be faster because I've already written a bunch of scenes from it. But I'm sorry it's taking so long, but the ending is right. and you will like it. You will love it when you get it. I've already read it. So I'm going to go ahead and read to you from chapter 1. I choose chapter 1 this time. I read from several different places, but it feels like the right place to start, simply because it's a place where you can see some of Jim's words and some of my words. Specifically, I don't say a lot about what Jim wrote and what I wrote. I try to stay away from that. I eventually will reveal these things, if Harriet lets me, after the third book is out. But as we know, the first paragraph is always the same. Those are Jim's words, and some of the other words are mine. I ask that you not, particularly on the first read, concern yourself overly much on which is which. If you do want to read some of Jim's writing, read the first scene of the prologue about the farmer, which was one of the very, in fact, I think it's the very last scene he worked on. He dictated it on his deathbed, line by line. So you can read that, and that entire scene was Jim's. There is, of course, some editing and some revisions that I had to do because he just kind of off the cuff said it, but I left as much as possible, and I didn't add or take anything away from the actual narrative. So go ahead and read that sometime and think of Robert Jordan. And chapter 1, Tears from Steel. The wheel of time turns. And ages come and pass, leaving memories that become legend. Legend fades to myth, and even myth is long forgotten when the age that gave it birth comes again. In one age, called the Third Age by some, an age yet to come, an age long past, a wind rose around the alabaster spire known as the White Tower. The wind was not the beginning. There are neither beginnings nor endings to the turning of the Wheel of Time, but it was a beginning. The wind twisted around the magnificent tower, brushing perfectly fitted stones and flapping majestic banners. The structure was somehow both graceful and powerful at the same time, a metaphor, perhaps, for those who had inhabited it for over 3,000 years. Few looking upon the tower would guess that at its heart it had been both broken and corrupted separately. The wind blew, passing through a city that seemed more a work of art than a workaday capital. Each building was a marvel. Even the simple granite shop fronts had been crafted by meticulous Ogier hands to evoke wonder and beauty. Here a dome hinted at the form of a rising sun. There a fountain sprang from the top of a building itself, cresting what appeared to be two waves crashing together. On one cobbled street, a pair of steep three-story buildings stood opposite one another, each crafted into the form of a maiden. The marble creations, half-statue, half-dwelling, reached with stone hands toward one another as if in greeting, hair billowing behind, immobile, yet carved with such delicacy that every strand seemed to undulate in the wind's passing. The streets themselves were far less grand. Oh, they had been laid out with care, radiating from the White Tower like streaks of sunlight. Yet that sunlight was dimmed by refuse and clutter, hints of the crowding the siege had caused. And perhaps the crowding wasn't the only reason for the disrepair. The short storefront signs and awnings hadn't seen wash or polish in far too long. Rotting garbage piled where it had been dumped in alleys, drawing flies and rats, but driving away all others. Dangerous toughs lounged on the street corners. Once, they'd never dared do that, and certainly not with such arrogance. Where was the White Tower, the law? Young fools laughed, saying that the city's troubles were the fault of the siege and that things would settle down once the rebels were quelled. Older men shook their gray-streaked heads and muttered that things had never been this bad, even when the savage Aiel had besieged Tarvalon some 20 years previously. Merchants ignored both old and young. They had their own problems, mainly on South Harbor, where trade into the city by way of the river had nearly come to a halt. Thick-chested workers toiled beneath the eyes of an Aes Sedai wearing a red fringed shawl. She used the one power to remove wards and weaken the stone, while the workmen broke the rock apart and hauled it away. The workmen had sleeves rolled up, exposing curls of dark hair along burly arms as they swung pick or hammer, pounding at the ancient stones. They dripped sweat onto rock or into water below as they dug at the roots of the chain that blocked passage into the city by river. Half of that chain was now indestructible Kuendiar, called Heartstone by some. The effort to tear it free and allow passage into the city was an exhausting one. The harbor stoneworks, magnificent and strong, shaped by the power itself, were only one of the more visible casualties of the silent war between the rebel Aes Sedai and those who held the tower. The wind blew through the harbor, where idling porters stood watching the workers chip the stones away one by one, sending flakes of gray-white dust to float on the water. Those with too much sense, or perhaps too little, whispered that such portents could only mean one thing. Tarmangaidan, the last battle, must quickly be approaching. We will stop there.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.